From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we took a look at Al Gore's choice for vice presidential nominee, Joe Lieberman, his record, and the Democratic Leadership Council. Also, Philadelphia, hundreds of people are still locked up, some as high as $1 million bail. We'll look at their situation. And the strike at Verizon. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Philadelphia judge yesterday reduced bail for John Sellers of the Ruckus Society from an unprecedented $1 million to $100,000. Sellers is charged with misdemeanors for allegedly orchestrating property damage during protests at the recent Republican National Convention. He was not arrested at a demonstration, but while he was walking down the street. He denies the charges. Co-defendant Terrence McGuckin's bail hearing is postponed until today. McGuckin is a leader of ACT UP. He's being held on $450,000 bail. We'll have more on this story later in the show. Authorities in Philadelphia have dropped attempted murder and aggravated assault charges against carjacking suspect Thomas Jones. He, of course, is the African-American man who was dragged from a car and beaten by a mob of police officers just days before the beginning of the Republican National Convention. The charges were dropped yesterday as police said a policeman was actually wounded by a fellow officer, not by Thomas Jones. His beating was caught on videotape. Following up on a story we did yesterday, more than 100 people protesting the U.S.-led U.N. sanctions on Iraq were arrested yesterday in front of the White House. About 250 people armed with signs saying sanctions are mass murder and sanctions suck the life out of countries gathered in Lafayette Park across from the White House to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the sanctions against Iraq. According to various U.N. agencies, the sanctions have caused the deaths of more than 1 million Iraqis, many of them women and children. The protesters could be given a maximum sentence of 1 year in jail for demonstrating without a permit. This news from Alaska. Six environmental activists boarded a barge carrying oil drilling equipment early yesterday in the Arctic Ocean to protest BP Amoco exploration plans, this according to BP, according to Greenpeace. BP officials said the tug towing the barge had been diverted to Barrow, a small town in the northernmost tip of Alaska where local police plan to remove the activists. Greenpeace is protesting BP's North Star offshore drilling platform, which is under construction off the north coast of Alaska in the Arctic Ocean. North Star would be the first offshore drilling operation in the Arctic Ocean, and Greenpeace maintains it would threaten the Arctic ecosystem. Greenpeace wants BP to cancel the North Star project and use the money saved to fund solar power initiatives. It got 13% of BP shareholders to vote to stop the project in April. And Texas Governor George W. Bush is scheduled to execute two men tomorrow night, one of whom may be mentally handicapped. Unless the courts or Bush himself intervene, Brian Robertson and Oliver Cruz are set to die by lethal injection in consecutive executions at the state prison in Huntsville, Texas. Oliver Cruz's attorney told Reuters his client is mentally retarded because he scored less than 70 on an IQ test. Even in Texas, multiple executions are rare, and the question of whether mentally ill people should be put to death has been discussed in the Texas legislature. 13 states prohibit executing the mentally ill. Texas has executed 225 people since resuming capital punishment in 1982 after a national death penalty ban was lifted, but only twice in that time have two people been put to death on the same day. Two other states, Illinois and Arkansas, have performed multiple executions on one day during the same period. Accusing the United Nations of allowing ethnic cleansing to persist in Kosovo, the Belgian branch of the humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders announced yesterday it's ceasing operations in Kosovo. The group said the Belgian doctors have been eyewitnesses to the daily harassment and terror against the Serb minority in multiple towns, as well as the Albanian minority in the northern part of Mitrovica. The group said life for ethnic minorities was marked by killings, drive-by shootings, hand grenade attacks, verbal abuse, threats, robbery, and blackmail. The group said many minorities had been forced to leave their homes since NATO and the UN assumed control. In this news from London, an anti-landmine group in Britain called today for a global moratorium on the use of cluster bombs, saying a large number failed to explode on impact and were left lying dangerously on the ground. Cluster bombs have scores of bomblets that scatter over a large area, shredding nearly everything in their path. They were used widely during U.S. and British-led attacks in Vietnam, the Persian Gulf, and in NATO's 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia last year. And Green Party nominee Ralph Nader has submitted enough signatures to appear on 34 state ballots and hopes to be on the ballot in as many as 45 states this fall. In addition, the campaign has filed lawsuits challenging tough ballot access laws in North Carolina, Illinois, South Dakota, and as well Oklahoma. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Vice President Al Gore has picked Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman to be his running mate, putting a Jew on a national ticket of a major party for the first time in U.S. history, and choosing the first prominent Democrat to chastise President Clinton openly for his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Gore is to announce his decision today at noon in Nashville, Tennessee. But what is Joe Lieberman's record on the important issues of the day? We're joined right now by two people to talk about where he stands and also his relationship with the Democratic Leadership Council, an organization within the Democratic Party that has pushed it very much to the right. We're joined by Ira Gruper, who is the former national co-chair of the New Jewish Agenda, active in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, served on the Greater Louisville, Kentucky Central Labor Council, has just returned from 6 months in Jerusalem. And Gerald Horn is with us. He is professor of African and African American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Well, let's begin with Professor Horn. Can you tell us about Joe Lieberman's record?
Joe Lieberman's record is basically a legislative chamber of horrors. You might know that he was catapulted into the United States Senate some 12 years ago by defeating the then center-left Republican Lowell Weicker with a red-baiting anti-Castro Cuban campaign. He is known to have received substantial support from the right-wing Miami Cuban community. He was supported in his race by the patron saint of conservatives, William F. Buckley, the founder and publisher of the National Review, the conservative magazine. Joe Lieberman is pro-death penalty. He's pro-school vouchers, which, of course, will undermine the public school system. He's hostile to affirmative action. He has been a faithful servant of the military-industrial complex. As you know, Connecticut is one of the largest recipients of Pentagon dollars, and Joe Lieberman has served that constituency quite well. He is pro-theater missile defense, which, of course, will probably destabilize relations between the United States and Russia and the United States and China and the United States and the European Union. He also voted in 1994 to support a bill that denied funding to public schools that were, quote, supportive of homosexuality, unquote. In other words, he's very close to the cultural conservative community as well. In short, Joe Lieberman's record is not reassuring, to put it mildly, to those who happen to be anywhere left of center.
Ira Gruper, your first impressions when you heard that Joe Lieberman, the Connecticut Democratic senator, would be Al Gore's running mate?
I'm very pleased that a Jewish person can move up to the highest office in the land, or the second highest office. Well, his purpose there is to do the bidding of the president, and hope that when the president dies or finishes his office, that he can accede to the throne. But Lieberman's background has to be looked. We have to look at the content of his character. He finished Yale at the age of 27, was a liberal then. He defeated Ed Marcus for the Connecticut State Senate. The liberals turned out in the primary to support Lieberman. Lieberman served a few terms in the state Senate, perhaps 10 years or so. And then he became Connecticut's attorney general, where he advocated for consumer interests. He was a liberal then. Then he ran for Congress, and he lost. And that was his wake-up call. He saw which side his bread was buttered on. And so when he ran against Senator Lowell Weicker, he put on a filthy, dirty campaign, accusing Weicker of being soft on Cuba. So Professor Horn talked about it. It turned out that Lowell, that Lieberman had gotten money from Cuban emigres in the United States. Lieberman accused Weicker of having a poor attendance record in Congress. This was baloney. Weicker had stated that Palestinians had valid concerns. So Lieberman then attacked Weicker, saying Weicker was anti-Israel. Lieberman was then getting support from this guy, Yitz Greenberg, a right-wing rabbi who now is in New York and has this right-wing group, Klal. So Lieberman's record is not very pretty. He says he favors negotiations with the Palestinians, and he says that Israel must increase security. The Palestinians must then come up with more and more and more. He's been reluctant to pressure Israel under any circumstances, refusing to recognize the PLO until Israel did. So I'm trying to say that, on the one hand, I'm very pleased that anyone, regardless of race, sex, age, disability, sexual orientation, etc., can move up, although I'm not so sure about the sexual orientation at this juncture. But we have to look at Lieberman according to his record.
Let's talk about the Democratic Leadership Council. Professor Gerald Horn, how did it rise out of the Democratic Party, and what role does Senator Lieberman play in it?
Well, there was grave concern when Reverend Jesse Jackson launched his Rainbow Coalition and his tries for the presidency in the 1980s. It was feared by some that Reverend Jackson would help to tug the Democratic Party to the left. As a result, you saw this DLC rising to bring the Democratic Party back to the right. And as of now, Joe Lieberman has played a leading position in the DLC, and in fact embodies many of those center-right values has come to exemplify, such as support for the death penalty, vigorous support for the military-industrial complex, etc.
Gerald Horn, what do you think this means for Al Gore? I mean, is Joe Lieberman really that different from Al Gore? They agree on major trade issues, as Gore agrees with Bush, for example, on NAFTA, etc.
Well, it's unclear to me, contrary to what the pundits are saying, whether this will be a boost for the Gore candidacy. Just as it was thought that the selection of Dick Cheney basically provided a boost for Al Gore, in the sense that he did not help to broaden the base for George Bush's race, I don't really see Lieberman broadening the base for Al Gore's race. And as a result, you might see that Al Gore might take a dip in the polls. Certainly, many progressive voters who have been wavering as to whether or not they should vote Green or vote Democrat might decide to vote Green because of Joe Lieberman's rather center-right record.
What about on other issues of foreign policy? Gerald Horn, you've spent the last years in Zimbabwe, also in Hong Kong.
Well, as I said, Joe Lieberman has been a faithful servant of the military-industrial complex. He has voted down the line with the right wing on many critical questions, such as theater missile defense, the so-called son of Star Wars, which Vladimir Putin has already denounced, Jiang Zemin of China has denounced, but Joe Lieberman has supported. Our grouper has already talked about how he's lagged behind the peace movement in Israel with regard to the Middle East peace process. This is something that course, does not distinguish him in some ways from any other Democratic Party politician. But on the other hand, it's not reassuring for those who are looking for a reason to vote Democrat. And as has already been suggested, when the U.S. is moving towards some sort of detente with Castro's Cuba, Joe Lieberman is lagging behind on that question as well. This, too, is not reassuring.
Ira Grouper, what do you think this would mean, for example, for the Middle East peace process? I mean, you said his views on it, but what effect does, if he were to become vice president, would Joe Lieberman have?
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that. I don't know. I would venture to say that Lieberman has not been overly enthusiastic about the moves that Clinton has made to try to bring about some sort of rapprochement between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's very interesting. Politics make strange bedfellows, but bedfellows make strange politics. I don't think that Clinton wants the last mark on his record when he has stuff put in his presidential library to be his relationship with Monica. So I think that Clinton very sincerely is trying to bring about a peace agreement. He tried his best at Camp David, and now there's continuing negotiations. If Lieberman to the throne, I don't know that he would be as assiduous in pushing this at this moment. Now, this is not to say that he's just a knee-jerk reaction to Israeli policy, that whatever they say will be done, and any more than John F. Kennedy was a knee-jerk reaction to the Vatican in the 1960s. I think that that's a stereotype which must be combated. Nonetheless, his politics are consistent with the more right-wing views. Very interesting. You talked about broadening the base, and I agree with Mr. Horn's comments, but I would also say that there's a negative side and a positive side to broadening the base. I think that many liberals may not vote Democratic, but many conservatives who are leaning toward the Republican Party may vote Democratic now. As far as foreign policy is concerned, I think that the United States basically wants stability in the world. I don't know that we've ever been known as the great peacemakers. We can ask the Cherokee Nation about our peacemaking potential. In order to have stability, you have to be able to have peace. And so the United States, I believe, sincerely wants peace. Joe Lieberman will pursue that policy. How it plays itself out in the real world remains to be seen.
What about the issue of labor? Ira Grouper, your former national co-chair of the New Jewish Agenda, active in the civil rights movement. You also write a monthly column on the labor movement.
Yes, the column I write is Labor Pains, P-A-E-A-N-S. I think that it's very interesting, not just the business of Lieberman, but Gore and the labor movement. Lieberman favors NAFTA like Gore does. He's not a person that is known as a friend of labor. He's consistent. He's not an aberration or a misordering of priorities. He's part and parcel of the Democratic Party leadership in that way. I was recently at a rally that was organized by organized labor here in Louisville. The Kentucky AFL-CIO organized it at the IUE, the Electoral Union. Well, it was packed with, and the people who spoke with the Texas Truth Squad. These are ordinary Texans organized by the AFL-CIO to travel around the country to show what life is like under George Bush. Their points were great. And then Ron Trumka, the Secretary Treasurer of the National, and I have great respect for Rich Trumka, got up and talked about Gore as being the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I would imagine that he would talk also about Lieberman as being the greatest thing since sliced bread. If he had said that Gore is a disaster, but we don't want Bush to get in, that would be honest, and that would give people a certain reason to vote. But many of my colleagues who were at this meeting just sort of shook their head that the Democratic Party perhaps lost its credibility or the labor movement lost some credibility by uncritically supporting Gore. I think that when you add Lieberman to the mix, you're adding a little bit more fuel to the fire.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Ira Gruper, former chair, national co-chair of the New Jewish Agenda, and Professor Gerald Horn teaches African and African American studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Joe Lieberman can run for Senate as well at the same time that he's on the ticket for vice president, on the Democratic Party ticket. If he wins one, he'll resign as senator, and the governor of Connecticut would then choose a senator to replace him until there is an election. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at the Verizon strike, and we're going to Philadelphia to find out why hundreds of people still remain in jail and find out about these unprecedented bails that have been set for people charged with organizing the protests, not only in Philadelphia, but before that in Washington and Seattle. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the third day of a strike by 87,000 telephone operators and line technicians at Verizon Communications. Yesterday, progress slowed in contract talks between the company and its unions. One of those unions, the Communication Workers of America, said the stumbling block revolves around job security, forced overtime, and union access to jobs in the wireless telephone unit. The union's desire to organize workers at Verizon's wireless unit has been one of the most contentious issues in the contract debate. The unions also want to limit the company's use of outside contractors and reduce workers' stress on the job. Verizon is a new company created by the merger of Bell Atlantic and GTE. Workers went on strike at 12:01 a.m. on Sunday, immediately after their previous two-year contract expired. The walkout by a third of Verizon workers is the second strike in 2 years at the company. Picket lines swelled yesterday as union members wore red T-shirts, carried signs, and chanted union slogans at hundreds of Verizon facilities. About 14,000 union members picketed more than 540 of Verizon offices, compared with 6,000 picketers at 300 locations on Sunday. Bob Masters is with us. He's the Northeast Strike Coordinator for the CWA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob.
Thank you.
So, tell us the main issues of this strike.
Well, before I do that, I just have to take this opportunity to say that the 14,500 figure that the company announced yesterday as the number of picketers on the picket line is completely made up, and there were way, way more people on the picket lines. I know of one location in Lower Manhattan alone where there were 1,200 people on the picket line yesterday morning, so given that there are 550 sites all around the region, if we had 1,200 at one site here in Manhattan, there were many tens of thousands on the picket line yesterday. In terms of the issues, you stated them pretty clearly in your lead-in. The main issues here are jobs, job security, and our members' future. The big concerns are about the impact of the merger on our members' job security, in particular the company's freedom to move work out of the region to low-wage, non-union sectors of the country, and also this whole issue of enhancing the organizing rights of the Verizon Wireless workers.
Explain what Verizon Wireless is.
Verizon Wireless is the new cellular company that was formed along with the big Verizon merger. It consists of three different parts. There's the old Bell Atlantic Mobile, there's the GTE cellular operation, and then there's the Vodafone AirTouch company. Vodafone is a British company that bought out AirTouch. AirTouch was the old Pacific Telesis cellular company. So you have about 32,500 workers at Verizon Wireless. We have one very small bargaining unit of cell site technicians, people who maintain the actual cell sites where the signals are transmitted from in the New York metropolitan area of only about 45 workers. And the company has a history of really very anti-union behavior. When Bell Atlantic and 9X Mobile merged, this goes back about 5 years, and we had the bargaining unit at 9X Mobile, they tried to decertify us. And in fact, they said it was a new company and they would no longer recognize the contract. We actually have 85 technicians who belong to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers up in Boston who still are fighting to get back their union representation at the wireless company.
Where did Verizon get its name?
I think they spent many hundreds of thousands of dollars on focus groups trying to figure out a new name, and that's what they came up with.
And how big is it?
Verizon Communications, the parent company, is the largest telecommunications company in the country. There's 260,000 employees altogether. When you add in Bell Atlantic and GTE, they have by far the most customers, by far the biggest revenue. They're a company which really is shaping the industry right now.
What is the state of the contract talks?
I think the good news is that they're still talking, and they were going back into bargaining again this morning. As you reported, you know, in your opening, things have slowed down a little bit. There seemed to be some good progress. There's definitely some forward motion on this issue of increasing the rights of the Verizon Wireless workers to organize. What we're looking for in that area is what's called card check recognition and neutrality, where if 50% of the workers plus one sign a card saying we want to be in the union, then the company grants them recognition rather than having to go through an NLRB supervised election. And those elections are generally accompanied by all kinds of threats and intimidation. And even right now, the company is putting out a lot of anti-union propaganda to its employees. So there was some forward motion in that area, although no deal has been finalized by any means. But we're still hung up over these issues like the transfer of work, our rights to do some of this new technology work, like the DSL installations. There's a new wrinkle today. It turns out that Verizon's announced they've bought a DSL provider called Northpoint, so that's going to add some complications. So things have slowed down over finalizing the details of these agreements.
Well, Bob Masters, I want to thank you for being with us, Northeast Strike Coordinator for the Communications Workers of America.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In the last 24 hours, two women scaled a building in downtown Los Angeles and unfurled a 1,500-square-foot U.S. flag displaying corporate logos as stars. The banner featured the logos of U.S. companies, including Citigroup, Nike, Enron, and Occidental Petroleum, all major contributors to the Democratic and Republican conventions. The flag banner was flanked by huge painted images, which are part of a towering Apple Think Different ad that was already there. The ad features Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, and Cesar Chavez. The giant flag was hung on the Figueroa Hotel across the street from the Staples Center, where the Democratic Convention will take place next week. The banner displayed the website www.soldoutusa.com. This comes as more than 190 people continue to be held in prisons and jails in Philadelphia, stemming from the mass arrests during the Republican National Convention last week. There are reports that many prisoners are holding hunger strikes behind bars and that treatment inside the jails is not good. Some of those who have been released said that many jailed protesters were dragged along the floor, were denied phone calls to lawyers and friends, sometimes for days, and were refused medical treatment for various ailments and conditions. Among those being held are John Sellers of the Ruckus Society. He's been held on $1 million bail on numerous misdemeanor charges. Yesterday, he had a bail reduction hearing where his bail was dropped to $100,000. But Kate Sorensen of ACT UP Philadelphia and R2K continues to be held on $1 million bail. Others are being held on six-figure bails as well. Han Chan is with us. He's program director for the Ruckus Society. And Sarah Marcus has joined us. She's an activist with R2K Legal, which is working on the cases of the more than, well, close to 200 people still behind bars. Han Chan, let's start with John Sellers' bail reduction hearing yesterday. What happened? What is he charged with, and where does he stand now?
Well, he's charged with seven different charges, and each of those charges also has a conspiracy charge that goes along with it. They're all misdemeanors, and essentially what it seems like, as far as John's lawyer is concerned, is that they aren't necessarily going to try to show that he committed any of the charges, any of the crimes he's charged with, but that he is somehow legally, criminally responsible for things other people did, because he was behind the scenes calling shots by cell phone, which is obviously pretty preposterous to us. His bail, as you said, was reduced to $100,000, and we're looking into at least raising 10% of that, looking into bailing him, just trying to figure out what's going to be the smartest thing to do, and you know, whether or not John is most valuable in jail or out of jail. Obviously, he thinks that he can help raise some money to help other folks if we can get him out. So we're looking into that today.
And what about the other person who has the bail reduction hearing today? Is it Kate Sorensen?
Yes.
What is going to be presented in her defense, and what do you expect to see? What is she charged with?
Well, I'm actually not sure of her latest charges. I was told that they were looking possibly to tack more charges on. Obviously, we feel like it's fairly political, and that these bails are obviously punitive. But she is she works with ACT UP. She also works with the Ad Hoc Coalition to Defend Healthcare, and she is she's not just a direct action activist. She's a community leader. She's someone who's been involved with the community. Philadelphia ACT UP is largely African-American folks from South Philadelphia who are HIV positive. And she's perceived as someone who's done some incredible community organizing. And, you know, I guess we're just going to kind of play wait and see and then have to react today when we see what happens with her bail.
Sarah Marcus, tell us about the people who are in jail right now.
Okay, first of all, I wanted to address the issue of the 180 to 200 people still in jail. Those are the police's numbers, and we actually have far higher numbers based on the information we've been getting from people calling us in. We at R2K Legal Collective believe that actually the number of protesters who are still in the Philadelphia prison system tops 300. Yesterday our number was at 323, and we're getting forms on everyone as they get released, so we actually think the number's a lot higher than the police are putting it. Now, these people have been, when they were arrested, many of them were held in what's known as the Roundhouse downtown, and that was where the most egregious tales of police brutality were taking place. That was where we were hearing about people being hog-tied, ankle to opposite wrist, and left in that position for hours, sometimes overnight, in plastic cuffs, pulled so tight that people's extremities would turn blue, they would lose circulation, people were bleeding from that. People were also punched, kicked, thrown against walls. We had a report of one man being dragged face first through a trough that runs in the floor the length of the hallway of cells into which people throw refuse, spit, urine, dragged face first through that. Lots of people telling stories of being hogtied ankle to wrist and being dragged or forced to walk. So these tales we were getting, these people were calling them up, especially the women who had access to the phones would call us up and say, we hear the men down the hall, they're screaming, stop the torture. They're screaming for a medic. What can we do? Fortunately, at this point, most everybody has been moved to the county jails. And while we're not hearing many stories of abuse in the county jails, we're also really concerned about the people we haven't heard from. People are much more spread out in the county jails, and very few people have been getting phone calls. We've heard from very few. So we're still really concerned about our folks inside. At the same time, the ones that we do speak to, they say that their sense of solidarity is very strong. These people who are inside, there's a bit of of misinformation out in the world about why don't these people just give their names and get out. I mean, the reason is that they're practicing jail solidarity. They're refusing to be released until the city agrees to deal with them as a group. They feel that they shouldn't be addressed as individuals because they're in jail for collective action. They're trying to retain control over how the city deals with them. So, as I said, out of an initial somewhere around 480 people who were arrested, we believe we have 323 still in jail, which is about 70% of people choosing to stay in solidarity and demand to be treated as a collective.
I don't think jailhouse solidarity is something that a lot of people in this country understand. Where did the whole philosophy and strategy come from?
Jailhouse solidarity is a lot older than the current direct action movement. It's been used in civil rights and political movements in this country and around the world for longer than I can remember. Of course, I'm pretty young. But, I mean, the general idea is that the prison system is developed to try and disempower and break and separate people from each other. And if people can focus on working together, having consensus meetings whenever they can get enough folks together to have it, making decisions as a group, we can retain some level of control over what's happening to us and have a bit of leverage in the process of dealing with the system that holds our bodies.
Han-Chun, what are the plans for Los Angeles? And again, if you can explain what the Ruckus Society is, the group that you work with.
Sure. Well, the Ruckus Society is a Berkeley-based nonprofit. We've been around about 5 years. What we're best known for is our action camps. We held a democracy action camp in the hills of Malibu near Los Angeles a few weeks ago. And it's basically a week-long intensive training in the tactics and the philosophies of nonviolent direct action, nonviolent civil disobedience. And, you know, as far as Los Angeles, that camp is probably going to be Ruckus's largest contribution to the organizing around L.A. We are here simply to try to support a lot of other excellent organizations, community leaders in Los Angeles who are planning things. And essentially, if you want more information, d2kla.org is a great resource. D2K is the umbrella coalition that has set up sort of theme days that deal with different social justice, human rights, and environmental issues that people are going to be trying to raise during the Democratic National Convention. Every day there's going to be different nonviolent direct actions to send very specific messages about very specific concerns that different folks in L.A. Are trying to raise while the convention, while this you know, coronation essentially goes on, and while CEOs and corporate bigwigs hobnob with the politicians who are supposed to be exercising democracy and listening to what people have to say during the convention.
Sarah Marcus of R2K Legal Team, how does the treatment of the people who are jailed right now compare to what happened in Washington, the protests against the World Bank and the IMF, and Seattle, the protests against the World Trade Organization?
The brutality that's been committed against our people in Philadelphia far outstrips anything that we heard of in Seattle and D.C. There were accounts of police abuse in jail in Seattle and D.C., and there were accounts of people being psychologically and physically brutalized, but nothing of the systematic extent that we've been hearing in Philadelphia.
And finally, Han-Chun, the police commissioner of Philadelphia, John Timoney, calling on federal agencies and the FBI to get involved with tracking the organizers of these protests, saying that he doesn't want another city to be taken over. What does this mean?
Well, it means a few things. Obviously, to me, the first thing that it means is it's very troubling. It really represents a civil liberties crisis, as far as I'm concerned. But it also it belies a few other things. It really shows that both they really fear what this movement represents. They are nervous about the strength of the movement that embarrassed the WTO in Seattle, that's been able to really raise awareness about corporate globalization. And then the last thing that it belies is just a total lack of understanding about how this movement works, to think that they could target perceived leaders, perceived organizers like John, like Kate Sorensen, or even a handful of others, even 100 others, and think that they might be able to stop the momentum of a movement that has very valid and grave concerns about the state of our democracy. Well, that's not going to work.
Hanchan and Sarah Marcus, I want to thank you for being with us. Hanchan of Ruckus Society, Sarah Marcus of R2K Legal Team. Again, about 190 people continue to remain in jail and prisons in Philadelphia. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S.-based Achenese human rights campaigner has gone missing and is feared abducted in the Indonesian city of Medan, feared to be abducted by the military. Jafar Sadiq Hamza heads the New York-based International Forum for Aceh. He was reported missing on Saturday. We're joined by three people to talk about his case. Saraya Eid is an Achenese human rights activist in Philadelphia. Alan Nairn is a freelance journalist who has covered Indonesia and East Timor extensively. And we go to London for Carmel Budiarjo, who heads TAPL, which means political prisoner, an Indonesian human rights group. Can you tell us about Jafar?
Yes, I have known Jafar actually for quite a long time. I met him first at a conference about Aceh in Washington. That was in April last year. He was the really prime motivator of this meeting, which was to consider what we should do in the international community to raise concern about the human rights situation in Aceh. He was then, and still is, the chairman of the International Forum for Aceh. I had several meetings with him then in Washington about how we should function together and what my organization could do on Aceh as well. I later met him in July last year at another conference on Aceh, in which again he was the prime motivator, and that was the occasion when we set up an organization called the Support Committee for Human Rights in Aceh. I have always seen him as a very, very solid, very strongly dedicated human rights activist and very keen to inform the international community about Aceh. I met him then again on my brief visit. I was in Aceh for 3 days, just towards the end of my visit to Indonesia, and again I saw him in a different context, close with all the NGOs and also very, very close with his family.
Saraya Eid, you're in touch with his family. Can you tell us when Jafar disappeared, when he was no longer in contact with his family?
Jafar, according to his family, when I contact his family last 2 days, he lost his contact with his family a Saturday afternoon after 11:30.
Where was he going?
He go out to meet some friend in Medan, but he used to call his friend every 2 hours. After because in Medan it's not safe for the Achenese activities. As we know, many Achenese is kidnapped and tortured and killed in Medan, so we are supposed to ask Java to call friend and family if he is in Medan every 2 hours. So if he call every 2 hours, we know where he is. So after 2 hours, he never call his family. He called 11 o'clock and 11:20 at that day, but after 11:30, he never called. We are so upset what happened to Java, because he is our friend. He is always bring the about human rights violation in Aceh to international community, to inform international community about human rights violation in Aceh. And we lost him now, and we don't know where he is now, and we try to struggle to find him, and we will do whatever we can do to find him, even we have to put money for that.
Alan Nairn is also on the line with us, who went to Aceh last year. Freelance reporter, covers Indonesia and East Timor. Alan, can you put Aceh in the context of the politics of Indonesia, and what is the situation there?
I was in Aceh a couple of months ago, and the military and the police are still engaging in sweeps through villages where they pick up and often execute civilians. This is being sponsored by the Central Military Command in Jakarta, and it's being done with the tacit support of the U.S. And Gus Dur, the president of Indonesia, has sent ambiguous signals, but some in the military believe that he also is tacitly supporting the campaign of repression in Aceh. Their rationale is that they're facing a separatist movement. There's massive support for a referendum, on self-determination in Aceh among the population. Last year, they held a rally in the at the central mosque in Banda Aceh, where 1 million people turned out, calling for a self-determination vote. There is also an armed rebel, pro-independence group in Aceh, but most of the killings have been directed against the civilian population. And in fact, Jafar is one of the leaders in trying to arrive at a peaceful, democratic solution to reach a referendum, and if the people wanted independence by peaceful means. The military has often accused him of being one of the armed rebels. In fact, last year, the general in command of the Aceh region, General Afandi, made some public statements claiming that Jafar was a communist and a subversive and so on. He later told Jafar face-to-face, well, don't worry about what I said publicly. Nothing will come of it. But these are very ominous statements when they're made by the military. And now I hope Jafar has not paid the price for his daring to stand up for his activism.
How many people have been killed in Aceh, and geographically, where is it within Indonesia?
Aceh is on the far western tip of Indonesia, and it's very rich in oil. It's a major oil producer. Mobil is one of the prime companies there, Mobil Oil. And in fact, some of the killings of civilians have taken place on the premises of Mobil facilities. On some occasions, Mobil employees have been targeted by the Indonesian military and police and the local Achenese employees, and the company has done nothing to help them. And there have even been cases of burials, of clandestine burials by the military using mobile facilities, burials of civilians they have killed.
Carmel Budiarjo, you're with the group TAPO, which means political prisoner in Indonesian. You were a political prisoner when Suharto first rose to power. How does Aceh compare to the Indonesian occupation of East Timor? What is its history?
Well, I mean, the first thing that is striking about Aceh as compared to East Timor is that the international community is hardly aware of what is going on there. For the last 9 or 10 years, effectively from the time of Santa Cruz, of course, East Timor became increasingly a major issue on the international arena. This has not happened in the case of Aceh, although recently there has been more interest in the area, partly or largely because of the activities of Jafar himself. Now, that is one major difference between Aceh and East Timor. Of course, Aceh has, in a sense, a greater degree of sympathy within Indonesia itself, because people feel that Aceh has been part of the Republic since 1945 and that it made quite a big contribution to the anti-colonial struggle. So there is a greater openness. Public opinion is more open to listen to the information or to receive information about the violations, the terrible violations that have occurred there. So that, of course, was not the case with East Timor, where the minds of Indonesians were largely closed and knew very, very little about East Timor. But Aceh, of course, came into great prominence in 1998 after Suharto fell, when large numbers of people came forward, in particular women, the widows, came forward to talk about the human rights violations. And that, I think, came as a great shock to public opinion in Indonesia.
Alan, can you set this against the backdrop of U.S. policy towards Indonesia, which the U.S. cutting off weapons sale and military relationship with Indonesia, at least they said they were, around the time of the Timorese self-determination vote?
Well, after the East Timorese voted overwhelmingly for independence in the UN-sponsored referendum, the Indonesian military, using their militias, destroyed East Timor. They staged massacres in churches like the church in Swai. They burned down 80% of the housing stock. And because that got finally some attention in the international press, and because of fierce pressure from the U.S. grassroots and the U.S. Congress, Clinton was compelled in the middle of the terror to cut off U.S. Weapons sales and training for Indonesia. A week after that cutoff, Clinton was saying that he was hoping to renew the aid. He was prevented from doing that, though, by public and congressional opposition. But now, in recent weeks, the Pentagon in particular has been pushing to slowly restore elements of the military aid. They have just done a military exercise called CARAT, C-A-R-A-T, in which the U.S. Navy and Marines work with the Indonesian Navy and Marines to stage mock amphibious landings on various Indonesian islands. Just recently in the Indonesian papers, there was a photo of an Indonesian commander posing in a U.S. tank with a U.S. Trainer behind him. Just last Friday, coincidentally the day before Jafar disappeared, the Indonesian Air Force staged an exercise using American Maverick air-to-ground missiles. These are missiles that cost $225,000 apiece. They were supplied to the Indonesian military by the United States. They're manufactured by Raytheon. And they put on this exhibition where they were firing the missiles from U.S.-supplied F-16s and destroying targets on the ground. These missiles are equipped with a special infrared system that enables them to home in on the target. And it was a clear, I think, display of the military trying to flaunt the fact that it has U.S. Support. The fact that Clinton administration is trying to fully restore backing for the Indonesian military gives encouragement to that military, which is now engaged in a really a life and death struggle with the popular movement in Indonesia. There's a strong movement trying to break the illegitimate power of the army, the navy, and the air force, the marines, the police, all of which are repressive forces. They are continuing to kill civilians, not just in Aceh, but also in West Papua, and in repressing labor and peasant demonstrations all over the country. And yet at this crucial moment, the State Department and Pentagon in particular are doing their best to try to shore up that military and also the police. The police have been at the forefront of the village sweeps in Aceh. The chief of police in Aceh came out and declared openly that they would crush opposition. And yet at this moment, the U.S. is pushing for an anti-terrorism training program of the police that would involve training them in the tactics of terrorism on the claim that they would use them to protect civilians rather than attack them. And they are also moving forward with crowd control training for the Indonesian police. This can be stopped by the U.S. Congress if enough people pressure the Congress.
And what do you think needs to be done here in the United States to find out where Jafar is, the human rights activist who has disappeared in Indonesia and who lived in the United States for years working as a lawyer?
I think people here can do two things. One is to call the State Department in Washington and demand that they stand up for the safety of Jafar Siddiq Hamzah, and that they insist that the Indonesian military produce him alive and well. And secondly, they should call the military headquarters and the police headquarters in Medan, the city where Jafar was last seen. The telephone number for the military, the Indonesian military headquarters in Medan, is 011-6261-8451-300. That's 011-6261-8451-300. The police headquarters is 011-6261-7870-357. That's 011-6261-7870-357. And I can tell your listeners that these kind of calls are very effective. Because last fall, when I was imprisoned by the Indonesian military in East Timor, calls like this from the public to the place where I was being interrogated had a tremendous effect. It really shook them up. At this moment, we don't know where Jafar is, but there's an excellent chance that the military chief and the police chief in Medan know where he is and have some control over his fate.
Freelance journalist Alan Nairn, Carmel Budiarjo of TAPL, the Indonesian human rights group based in London, and Soraya Eat, Achenese human rights activist in Philadelphia, thank you for joining us. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. We had help from Nell Geiser. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!